Thank you all for coming, and thank you so much for coming. And thanks to M and to CET for making this whole series possible and providing a perfect setting for these conversations. And it's a perfect setting in differing ways for each of the conversations. First of all, we had a discussion of Americans in Old Shanghai. So it was a perfect setting because it's along the strip of buildings that were set up when the British and American interests were so strong in the international settlement of Old Shanghai. Then it was a perfect setting for a discussion of journalists and academics writing about China, because every journalist who comes to Shanghai has to write about the book one way or another. And now, in a discussion today about China in the 1980s and today, it's a perfect setting because everything you see out the window was not there in the 1980s, or rather, nothing that you see out the window when you look across the river was there in the 1980s. So we're trying to recapture, and in between the discussion of the distant past for Shanghai in the first session and the present last week, now we're looking at an often forgotten in-between period. If you go around Shanghai, you're continually reminded, bombarded with reminders of the pre-1949 history of the city as an international treaty port. And if you go to Yuyuan, you're even reminded of the history of the city to some extent before the Opium War and the period of internationalization. But you'll see very few reminders, at least explicitly, about what I call the post-Mao pre-McDonald's era, from the late 1970s to the late 1980s. You'll even see kitsch and other kinds of things reminding you of Mao's era, but you'll find very little that reminds you of that period, which all of us have strong feelings about, and so this is a special place to talk about that, in part because simply looking out at Pudong is a reminder of how much things have changed since then. I wanted to just get a quick setting. Is there anybody here in the audience who first came to Shanghai before the year 2000? All right, some of you, great. How about before the year 1990? It's a much thinner crowd. Well, yes, okay. It's a thinner crowd. Anyway, that will be the period that will be, for some of you, this may be nostalgic. For others, it may be a history, dare I say, a history lesson. I've started a tradition, and I'm really worried about this because I don't have one in store for the next talk. But I like to begin with a joke. And I try very hard to find a joke that connects the period that interests us here with the present. And luckily, I found one. Seek Truth from Facts, the title of this session, is a saying identified, a slogan identified primarily with Deng Xiaoping, even though Mao, it comes from Mao's writings. Mao was sort of like the Bible, Mao's collected works, he wrote on so many things so often that it becomes like the Bible or like the works of Shakespeare, not in quality, but in range. You can find a quotation that speaks to almost anything in Mao's writings, utopian or pragmatic. But Seek Truth from Facts became associated with Deng Xiaoping, but he was identified even more strongly with another saying, which was, it doesn't matter if it's a black cat or a white cat, if it catches mice, it's a good cat. This was his way of saying, let's worry less about ideology and worry more about getting things done. So that's a slogan that I've always taught in my classes about China when I get to the Deng Xiaoping period, but it took on a whole new meaning when I was giving a guest lecture at CET's Beijing program, and David Mosier, who was the person who invited me to give the talk, right before I was going to give the guest lecture, said, oh, I just got something in on my cell phone. This was the day after the American election, the last American election. And he said, he started laughing. I said, I've never gotten a joke on a Chinese cell phone. He said, okay, I'll send it to you. So I just bought my first Chinese cell phone, and the first text message I ever got translates basically like this. In America, for a long time, they could only elect a white president, never a black president. Then they read and were influenced by Deng Xiaoping's thought. And they realized it doesn't matter if it's a white president or a black president. If it can get us out of this mess, it's a good president. So with that segue from the 1980s up to the present, I want to turn more of this into a conversation, not a monologue. and just say I'm so delighted by these two, to be joined by these two people who I've had not only enjoyed reading, but had wonderful experiences with in different times. When Li Jia came and gave an excellent talk to a standing room only crowd at University of California, Irvine, where I'm based. And Graham, I had the great pleasure of being introduced by him the last time, well, the first time, and the last time that I spoke at the International Literary Festival here. Both of them, as Jeremy suggested, are impressive figures, but I don't think he gave you quite the range of both of their Renaissance man and woman qualities. Li Jia is not just a writer, she's given inspirational speeches, she's a talk show host in Beijing, she does the whole gamut of things. And Graham is a publisher, a writer, and also a singer and songwriter. So these are very wide-ranging figures who you'll get a sense of their talents and range during the conversation. What I want to do to start things off is ask each of them to talk about their most recent book and how the 1980s or the late 70s to the mid to late 1980s. And we don't want to collapse the 1980s. The only thing that comes to many people's mind when they think of China in the 80s is Tiananmen. And Tiananmen may come up, but it shouldn't be reduced to that. So I just want to know how in your book anything from that period, the late 70s to the late 1980s, comes into play, and if that leads you to any opening reflections on the similarities and differences between then and now. So why don't we start with you, Li Jia?
Thank you. I wrote a little memoir called Socialism is Great. I have to stress that this is not my political statement. It's a title of a song, "社会主义好." It's actually my publisher's idea. Anyway, when I first went to America for the book tour, American gentleman sitting next to me was outraged on my behalf. He said, "Who gave you this stupid title? Socialism is great. We Americans don't like socialism or communism." So ever since then, I have to attract people's attention to the quotation mark and the exclamation mark. And before, on July 1st, when I was working in the factory in the 80s, we always had a revolutionary songs competition. One of the must sing is Socialism is Great. I would be very happy to burst into singing for you, except my children ban me from singing in public, because I'm such a public embarrassment.
Maybe we can ask her to lift the ban later, but go on.
So when I tell people I recently published a memoir, people often look at me up and down and said, "But how old are you?" I often joke, "If you don't plan to marry me, why would you care how old I am?" Anyway, I think it's traditionally people write a memoir when they reach the old age or when they achieve greatly and they look back their life and write a memoir. I think in the modern memoir has changed. Anybody has an interesting story to tell, anybody can write a memoir. I hope my story is interesting or compelling enough to justify me to sit in front of you today. Today's topic is about the life in the 80s. I spent the entire 80s working at a rocket factory. Among other products, my factory produced intercontinental missiles that were capable of reaching North America. But I have to confess, I'm no nuclear scientist. I don't know any top secrets. I'm not a rocket scientist. But anyway, when I was 16, that was 1980, my mother just took me out of school and put me to work. I was 16 when in 1980, clever people can quickly work out how old I am exactly. That was just a few years after the nightmare of the Cultural Revolution, the unemployment was running high. So to solve the problem, there was a temporary policy which allowed the children to take over the parents' job if parents retired early. So my mother, being uneducated, I don't think she ever saw the benefit of education. So she thought the best thing a mother could do was to secure a job for her daughter, especially we call that Iron Rice Bowl. It's a state working for a state-owned factory. But I was, of course, the reason was simple, economical, and our family was very poor. So for her, she retired early for me to get this job, and she wanted me to regard it as a gift. But that's something I was unable to appreciate. I grew up in a residential compound. All my friends were the children of the factory workers. But I always had a grand plan for myself. I wanted to become a writer and journalist. But then I find myself, stuck at the factory. In fact, I worked there for 10 years. China now, enjoyed so much more personal freedom if there's no democracy. But back then, there were just so many rules. The first day I entered the factory, we were given a long list of rules, No high heels, no lipsticks. Within 3 years of entering the factory, there's no dating. And in fact, I worked for the factory for 10 years. I never got any promotion for one important reason. My big boss thought I wear a perm. In those days, only people with bourgeoisie outlook in life would wear a perm. So I didn't have the correct ideology. So I did not deserve a promotion. So anyway, so I'll just give an example to say how the rules we had to obey. So as escape route, I decided to teach myself English. So in the hopes of getting a job as an interpreter outside the factory. So of course, once I began to learning English, I just fascinated by the language system, so different from our characters. It was very difficult in those days to learn English. Unlike today, so many courses on offer, pirate DVDs readily on sale in every street corner. And I had to borrow a radio cassette from my cousin. And I'd followed a program called New Concept English. I mean, of course, now looking back, learning English really effectively changed my life because it's broadened my horizon. And what I learned was not just simply ABCs, but the whole culture package. I remember when my family situation improved, we bought a television. I also followed a program called New Concept English. It's called Follow Me. It's a co-production with
Kate
the
Flower.
Yes, exactly. Yes. She's absolutely wonderful.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so I remember I saw that. With amazement how grannies in England in their 70s would wear floral patterned dresses. And in China, at that time, China was just grey. And I bought quite a busy patterned skirt for my mother, and I don't think she ever wore it. She said, oh, people can laugh their teeth off. But anyway, I'm just obsessed in learning English. Sometimes I would find myself riding bicycle in the street, singing Carpenter songs. And I think you probably think the carpenters is a bit mad, but for us, the carpenters, they presented the high culture from the West because that was one of the very first Western bands to go on sale in China, cycling the street and sing a song, sing along. I see my children staring at me. So I've just become obsessed in learning English and also. Learning English really, also reading English books really changed me. I dared to be different. The idea, the concept of individualism took roots in me. So I dared to wear short skirts, I had boyfriends, and after my English improved, I began to listen to the BBC, which broadcast news very different from our propaganda. I also had boyfriends I was always very conscious. I was a little factory worker. I always went for better educated men who each, showed me one or two things about the world. And so by 1989, I just organized a demonstration among factory workers in support of the democratic movement led by the students. So my book is very much a personal journey of both sexual and political awakening, and interestingly, the journey I took back in the 80s also very much reflect what China went through. And for me and many of my friends, the 80s was the most fascinating time, because that's the time when, you know, China just began to change. Deng Xiaoping introduced the reform which slowly transformed China. That was time, in many ways, China became, was turned from a black-white picture to the colorful picture. It's a time when women were allowed to become women in a way, when feminine or wear colorful clothes. I remember one Western journalist said, after Deng Xiaoping introduced reform, Chinese women suddenly got breasts. I couldn't remember, because before all the women, men were wearing the same lumpy jacket. So I just think when I decided to do my book, I just did some research and I realized there are very hardly any memoirs set in the 80s yet, you know. But yes, I just say the 80s was a fascinating time, so see changes, and it's very relevant to today's China. If anybody wants to understand what's happening in today's China, I think the 80s was an important period to get to know. In many ways, it's China became what it is today. But anyway, that's one of the many reasons I launched myself to this project. And anyways, it's also today's topic of China in the 80s. I think I've probably overdone my time.
No, that's fine. No, that's great to start off. Let's turn to Graham, but afterwards I'd like you to share the story of your first trip to China.
Oh, yes, of course.
During that period. But let's go to you, Graham.
Sure. You know, the 1980s was a period of no change in China, basically. It refers to some of the things that Li Jiao was just saying. It was this sense of a whole country which was really recovering from a period of mass hysteria, a nervous breakdown. And it took more than 10 years for them sort of to recover as a group. China for 30 years had been closed to foreigners, and not only closed the country to foreigners, but had taken a view that foreigners were all evil, with the exception of a few from Albania and possibly Yugoslavia. But it was a place that was extraordinary to be in. It was closed off in a way that for many of you here, it will be impossible to really imagine how isolated and extraordinary it felt. I think if you were to put yourself mentally into Pyongyang, I think that would be close to what it felt like to be in China. And it was a great adventure for those of us who were there. We were one of a very small group of people who were able to be in China during that period and to experience the affairs of a quarter of mankind, which were so close to the rest of the world. And there was a very important principle at the time of Kaifeng and Bu Kaifeng, Dichu, places that were open and not open around the country. And 98% of China in the early 80s was closed. It was Bu Kaifeng. And Kaifeng, the places that were open, as a foreigner, you had to apply to go. Now, I at the time was a journalist working out of Beijing. And to go anywhere in China, including Shanghai, I had to put in a written request to the information department of the foreign ministry.
Quite right, too.
Li Jiao is nodding and agrees that this was the right thing. Things have gone downhill since then. We applied, and it took 2 weeks to get approval to come to Shanghai. To go to many other places, including places that are just sort of obviously a part of our world, like Fujian or somewhere, could take forever, for months and months, and you just had no idea if you would ever get a chance to go. And the reason I decided to do my walk across China, which Jeff kindly referred to, the reason I think I did it, one of the many reasons I did it, was as a celebration of the changes that have taken place in China since I first came to live here in the late 70s. I first came to Shanghai in 1979. And the fact that China has changed so much in almost all ways, there are still some ways where China has not changed. And depending on the nature of the conversation, I will tell you all the ways in which China has not changed since the 1970s. It makes for a more interesting conversation than talking about Pudong, but the fact is that China has changed in so many ways to the positive. And one of them is that I can now walk across China without seeking approval from anybody, without getting any permissions. I've met many police along the way, but in all cases, all of the confrontations that began with this is a foreigner, this is an outsider, it's probably a spy, we should take a negative view. That is, taking the view of the first 30 years, shall we say, of China's communist China's interaction with the Western world. But in all cases, it ended with them shrugging and saying, well, off you go. In one particular case, when I was walking through the prison farm region of Xiyan, which is on the western part of the Hubei Plain, hundreds of square kilometers of prison farms, and there's a public highway running right through the middle, and I had no idea what I was walking into when I entered this area. But I continued to photograph all the things that I saw, including water buffalo, etc. And I came upon a building, and I snapped it as I snap everything, basically. And that resulted in a major confrontation, major problems. I was taken off to a local police station. The building that I had taken a photograph of was a Laogai center, a re-education through labor center, that is a prison. And they spent 3 hours interrogating me and looking at the visas in my passport, and decided at the end that my story that I was just walking to Tibet was, while highly dubious, they couldn't think of any reason to keep me around.
Too crazy to make up.
Just too crazy to make up.
But it is extraordinarily, it's wonderful to be able to walk through China from the perspective of the 1970s and the 1980s, and to be able to experience the hospitality of Chinese people, the way that they treat strangers, either as guests or as people who can be left for dead on the streets. Of course, it goes both ways in Chinese culture. But overall, I've been treated with great hospitality. I get many invitations to dinner and to lunch and to tea as I walk through the villages. And I'm so glad that Deng Xiaoping managed to make his way back onto the top of the heap in 1978.
I can totally understand that. So for journalists, Western journalists working in China in the 80s, must be a fascinating while, but also there's so many rules, restrictions, frustrating as well. I know we're talking about your first trip to Shanghai. I think I first came to Shanghai in 1985. I was still working in a factory. My job was to test the pressure gauge. You know, while I was telling people I worked at a rocket factory for 10 years, people often go, wow, that must be fascinating. I could only describe it as a soul-destroying, mind-numbing experience, because the job I was assigned to was to test the pressure gauge. Anyway, one of the few perks I had was to bring the gadgets, the standard ones, to be tested in Shanghai. I loved such an opportunity, because at that time, traveling was not, even for Chinese, was not that easy. You know, before I get the permission to travel. So first of all, I had to go to exchange some liangpiao, rice coupon. Because and then I wouldn't be able to use Jiangsu. I live in Nanjing. I won't use my local rice coupon. And then I would get an introduction letter from my work unit. And with that introduction letter, I could stay at a hotel. I remember I stayed at a hotel which belonged to the Ministry of Aerospace. You know, my factories belonged to that. The eight people lived in the dormitory, the two bunk beds. The shower was miles away. Each person was given a benzene. So somebody, supposedly were washing your face, but people make other use of it, which you can read in my book. So anyway, I was thinking, in the 80s, how the restriction, the rules. But you were talking about the, for you, probably the your time with no chant. I think I wouldn't agree. I think the chant, probably took place quite slowly, but overall there was lots of chant took place in the 80s. And also that time, for example, I saw the best literature. There was before, the only thing we were allowed was Soviet literature or the revolutionary realistic style, and suddenly the literature was translated. I still also find this writing coming from China in the 80s, and also, artist field as well. And also, the 80s was time for still a lot of idealism, lots of dreamers and people today. I was a factory worker, I was busy reading Misty poems, and I'm not sure, we were with our friends, we were talking all the time, the Western style, democracy, the answer to China. Today's young people don't read so much, and if you read anything, probably books like How to Become a Millionaire, and How to Get Married, a Rich Husband, books, practical books like that.
Maybe something, it's the history professor in me, it's always breaking up periods, it's always interesting. When we talk about the 60s in America, we often collapse certain parts of that period. It's very shocking when you see film clips of the early 1960s when protesters are all in suits and ties, because we have in our mind the hippie period. But with China too, I think for the 80s, there may have been this slow change in the early 80s. Yeah. But the period when I first arrived in Shanghai in August of 1986 to spend a year at Fudan University. And when I think back at that period, I think about the enormous openness to different possibilities that there seemed to be in the country. This was a country that didn't know where it was heading. There was starting to be discussion of new ideas. There was no idea about where they would head. It was also a time, Shanghai was the most boring city I had ever lived in. And I hope the most boring city I ever lived in. There was just nothing to do. Partly I was at Fudan, which was way out of the city, before subway lines. But there were maybe two or three Hollywood movies that played in the city during the course of the year. There was just very little to do. There was no nightlife. There were no bars. I know, compared to Nanjing,
When I had trips like that, each time I had a long shopping list, because the people, for Nanjing people, and Shanghai was like we call that Hua Ha Shijie. It's almost kind of so prosperous, so colorful. And there's also things, also fashion. Shanghai always leads the fashion. Each time I would come to Shanghai, people would ask me buy high-heel shoes and lipsticks and things like that, which are not available in Nanjing.
Now I know this.
Slowly in the late 80s, now also there was KFC. Now I wouldn't go, but at that time I loved the salads.
And when there were foreigners who had come from another part of China, they say, you have it so soft here in Shanghai. You can get canned cheese. We can't get that either.
Yes, cheese.
But I think the boredom was important. The fact there wasn't that much to distract you from doing. People did spend a lot of time reading, not just novels, but
yes.
But students at the university were reading new philosophy. They were talking about what should this country be like. There was a constant openness to considering, which was part of what led to the ferment that was Tiananmen. It was partly about a desire for more choices in their individual life, more options. They'd gotten a sense of what was out there in that wider world and wanted more.
Yes, and then at the time, books like Nietzsche's books, God is Dead, and Freudian's books had just been translated, were selling like hotcakes.
How do you see this, Graham? If part of it is the early 80s, perhaps,
right,
and the mid to late 80s of this, because the last real crackdown on bourgeois tastes and attitudes, there was really in the mid-1980s, there was a small one in 1987, but
yes,
by then it really seemed, that was a very mild one to live through. By that point, there was this sort of momentum building toward opening, and yet there was still something that I look back to with nostalgia, which was people were still living relatively equal lives,
right,
within a given city.
Right.
And when I look back at the 80s, I also think about what has been lost in a city like this, because there wasn't so much of this sort of money being able to open all doors.
Right. No, there was a, I remember there was a fantasy that had a big impact on me because I had a band in Beijing called Peking All Stars, which was the best rock and roll band in China. It was also the only rock and roll band in China. But we had to cancel several concerts as a result of that. You know, I think that the idea of no change in China during the 80s basically comes down to things like, of course, there was a lot going on under the surface, a lot of intellectual exploration and thinking, which led to the Zhao Ziyang confrontation, which led to Tiananmen. But China throughout the 1980s was, in terms of the lives of ordinary people, was remarkably the same as it had been in, say, the 70s and before. This was still the kingdom of the bicycle. The forests of apartments that now dominate all cities of China did not exist. People's lives from cradle to grave were still ruled by the Communist Party. And it was only after 1989 that the Communist Party withdrew and allowed people to make decisions their own in terms of where they live, the careers that they do, everything except for do not challenge us in terms of the monopoly on nuclear power and only have one child if you're in the cities. But the overall, you know, the aim of Deng Xiaoping was to introduce capitalism in a very quarantined way. And Shenzhen, the economic zones, were full of factories which were financed by Hong Kong and Taiwan people. But the impact on Shanghai was minimal, really minimal. There was very little change to the outer appearance of the city, and it was considered to be a real breakthrough when permed hair became something that was allowable. Wenzhou hairdressers became the big thing.
I have natural curly hair.
But it was 1989. You had a lot of stuff that was building through the 1980s and led to 1989. And I think in many ways you could say that China is in the same process right now of collecting together all of the preconditions for some other leap.
Yes, and also I think you talk about Kaifeng. I think throughout the 80s, we saw a cycle of the tightening up and relaxation, and you know, every few years, I think the among top leaders also, the more liberal type or the more conservative type is fighting. But every few years, there will be a campaign of anti Zhang Jinhua, anti bourgeoisie tendency, and there were just things ridiculous. You know, for example, in the middle 80s, I can remember. Some Western fashion become, for example, Labaku, the flare trousers, which we call trumpet trousers because of the shape. That become the symbol of the capitalist, and it was become targeted. And I also remember very clearly there was an article in the newspaper cautioning people wear jeans. You know, jeans also, that's quite bad. And saying jeans are so tight on the backside could damage your fertility. Just imagine you to introduce that to the Catholics. Anyway, so although also the trousers, at my factory, people will stand at the gate and try to catch people. The trousers cannot be, the width couldn't be longer than 25th or something, couldn't be smaller than 15. And they saw all these things going on.
And you agree about, sorry.
Yeah. But anyway, I agree with you leading up to the to 1989, the democratic movement. I mean, that what happened in 1989 was very complicated. For one important reason, I think people were not happy. You know, some people got rich, not always through fair competition, and also people didn't have that much didn't enjoy personal freedom.
Right, there was a much more open discussion on things, and I was a journalist at the time, but we used to look through the newspapers for articles which indicated which faction was up and which faction was down. Factions have been kept under control in the past 20 years. But one of the things that was hotly debated was the whole issue of of culture and Western culture, and the extent to which it was going to damage the purity of China. But it's, nevertheless, it got in one way or another. My memory, Li Zhao's memory is of the carpenters. My memory is of going to a farmer's fair in Chufu in Shandong province in 1981. And it was like something straight out of the Middle Ages, except for a cassette boombox, which was playing Boney M. And my memory of those years is very closely related to Ma Baker. She had four sons. And also Ra Ra Rasputin and the others. And it was a reflection of the fact that they wanted to grab onto something that was from outside and they didn't know where to start. When we were playing, the Peking All Stars used to play concerts, and the Chinese in the audience, they knew they were supposed, they had a sense that they were supposed to move wildly. They'd seen some sort of Western movies indicating, you know, they'd seen, you know, the mashed potato perhaps, or the twist. But they just flail around in just complete wild abandon. That was their effort to try to match it. China was looking for a future, and it was after 89 that the road was finally found.
I want to make a point. I say in China, for today's China, in many ways, a far more liberal, open, human, relaxed. But in one aspect, but not always. For example, in the 80s, there was still a lot, you know, they said it wasn't very clear which direction China was going, but there was lots of debate about political reform. But now, today, that's already off limit. I was living in Nanjing. One of the reasons I loved to come to Shanghai was to buy the newspaper run by Qingbei Li called Shanghai Morning Herald, which was really introduced to wonderful, very investigative journalism, introduced to lots of ideas of Western style democracy. But anyway, that's
World Economic Herald.
Yes.
But knitting, these things are often thought of separately. We've moved from rock and roll to political debate, but they're actually interconnected. And one of my greatest regrets of Shanghai in the 86 was that I didn't go to a concert by Jan and Dean, who were the like lesser competitors to the Beach Boys in the 1960s in America. And they were one of the first, if not the first, pop groups to tour here, one of the first. And at their concert, there was a lot of excitement. This was in late 86 when Fan Lijie was giving speeches about democracy, and there started to be some protests. But when the protests picked up in Shanghai, it was after the Jan and Dean concert. Because at the concert, some students had wanted to dance in the aisle, and security guards had made them sit in their seats. And the students were outraged because they felt this symbolized the kind of frustrating world that they were part of, where they could sense what was out there, but they couldn't be part of it in the way that they knew they wanted to. They were also elitist. They said the security guards treated us like we were mere workers, when we're the intelligentsia. That was part of what led them onto the streets, and this kind of feeling was very much involved with Tiananmen as well. Rock and roll played a big part in the protests, Wei Jian's music and other rock music. And also this desire, and I think Graham put it very well, there was this desire for more choices in life. And after 89, the government, wanting to keep from having to deal with something like that, said, we're going to give you all the choices you can take, except the political ones. And life became ones where you had incredible numbers of choices, as you do now in Shanghai. What to do at night, what to buy, where to go, how to do this. If you have at least some money, then you have abundant choices. At that point, you didn't have choices, no matter what position you were in, but the political choices are withheld. Well, I want to open this to questions and comments and reactions from any of you, but before then, since music has come up several times, and we've heard about Graham's band, I know, like me, I've heard Graham speak before, I've read him, but I've never heard him play the guitar. So he does not have children who ban him from the party. So he is going to sing a song that he wrote in the 1980s. And maybe hasn't sung often since then, he warned me. So, all right.
Why not, eh?
Yeah. Oh, yes. That's right, yes.
So Can I play roadie here and hold a mic up
no,
there?
No, no,
you
no.
Can
I think,
blast it out there.
I okay. shall project. Ah! Just in case, I'll just...
Spanning the 80s to the present, he is going to make sure he doesn't forget his lyrics by looking at his iPad as he plays.
Which I used to play a lot. I used to, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of entertainment, as Jeff says, in those years. And so
I wish I'd known you.
There was an opportunity to play, you know, for in private parties and all sorts of other places. And I wrote a bunch of songs which were related to China in one way or another. This one was a rewrite of a song that was very popular in England in the 60s called "My Old Man's a Dustman." And the song, it was played, we played this one in a pantomime at the British Embassy in, I think, 1980, which was done each Christmas. And it was in a pantomime called Cinderella with an X. And the the character that I played was a waiter, a Chinese waiter, and he had a father who was a senior official. Which was not uncommon. Zhao Ziyang's daughter was a receptionist at the Great Wall Sheraton. It was a way to get out of the enclosed world. So this is the song. My old man is a carder. A carder, good God, is a communist official. It's a word that comes from the old Soviet Empire and was widely used in those days. They still exist, but the word has dropped out, along with the Mao jackets. But the mentality, I would argue,
and Tongzhi changed not. The meaning as well.
And Tongzhi has indeed.
I guess. Yes.
I am not a Tongzhi in either sense of the word. Now here's a little story. Please listen to me do. Now here's a little story. Please listen to me do. It's revolutionary and socialistic too, about my dear old father. At skiving he's the best, but when it comes to Guanxi, he would more than all the rest. The rest. Oh, my old man's Carter, he wears a Carter's cap. He has a big black limo with curtains in the back. And when I am a Carter, I'll be a lifeboat too. It's 25 years, you'll have to excuse me. Oh, my old man's a Carter. Should serve the likes of you. Oh, my old man's a carder, although he's 99. He sleeps through every meeting, but they won't let him resign. And when I am a carder, I'll be the same way too. And as for serve the people, well, I've better things to do. Lots of orders to the proletariat, and all you foreigners will be beneath my dignity, and I shall sit where you sit now, and you can wait on me.
All right.
Excuse me.
Questions, comments, and we have, Tina will be around with the microphone. Yes,
and actually we do have folks. We have Jeff's folks.
Oh, great.
So yeah, they're so
and Graham's you can order from Amazon, I assume.
Yeah. And Blacksmith Books in Hong Kong.
And Blacksmith Books in Hong Kong.
And my book didn't come from Charterhouse, from my special diplomatic channel.
Yeah.
And I don't think the authority particularly loves the book. when it was, anyway, as I started.
But we have copies back there, which are for sale.
Yes.
She
yeah.
bought
yes,
her personal diplomatic channel to sell and sign afterwards. But we have questions first and comments.
I just want to make sure the Graham's chair doesn't go off.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
It's fine.
The Great Fall of China. No, we don't
want the Great Fall of China.
First of all,
I'm
very grateful to Stephanie for having the performance. As I'm reminiscent of singing Berlin, between Berlin and Moscow in 1980. Mm-hmm. Shut down by the Berlin Guards. With the enthusiasm in terms of content and its political anchoredness in that context. Interesting, Jeffrey, because I was at the Don in 1986, 87, but I think after you left, because certainly I wouldn't have known if you were there, because there were no other foreigners besides myself except for Fulbright, a student and a scholar from America in Marxism from Berlin. So one question, one area or level that is not just diplomacy during that time period, and because 150 foreigners in Shanghai and then 350 in 1987 when Volkswagen broke the German managers and their wives, it was rather an intimate circle. And the women's club was very small in the international wives of the diplomats and I, one teacher who was here, as well as our former consul general, was here at the same time. But in terms of Legia's comments about literature,
literature published
in English, Betty Bell Lord was responsible for the first interviews of the stories of Chinese, and started that whole cycle, which created lots of stories that became very famous and very well read in America and in the West, translated into English. And she made that her mission. And I had interviewed her during that time period. And Winston Lord also had a successful, but then afterwards a bit controversial, diplomatic tenure here. So the question is, yes, is can perhaps Jeffrey comment on the diplomatic content?
Well, there were of course one set of foreigners who were around this mix, and there were some other as well. So diplomats were in a special kind of exalted range, but it was partly how separated foreigners were from the sort of ordinary life of China, which I think is what's so shocking if you come to China now and you get, and actually now you could argue the divisions within China have much more to do with money than they do with nationality. And so at that point, one of the wonders of being, and I was a student, maybe it was because I was a lowly student, not a teacher at that point, it was great. You could be as grubbily looking as you wanted, and you could walk into the nicest establishments set aside for foreigners. Whereas the nicest dressed Chinese, unless they were perhaps a cadre or a cadre's son, would be turned away and pushed away at the door. So there's been a pattern, and this to me is one of the eerie replications of, in fact, what happened in old Shanghai with the international settlement period. First, it was your skin color or your nationality that got you into the best places. By the 1930s or so, it started to be the rich of both classes, both of any nationality, could use the best places, and the poor of all were kept out. But here we are now.
But Jeff, I know you're interested in the no dogs, no Chinese sign. I remember in Beijing at the International Club, there was a restaurant that had a sign saying no Chinese. There was a restaurant that did not allow Chinese in.
Oh yeah,
Nanjing, the Jinling Hotel, which had the first time had the tallest building in China,
and
it wasn't allowed China to come to get in.
No, and in fact, when I started researching this, the myth and the legends around the no dogs or Chinese allowed inside, a Chinese friend of mine said, "Look, if you write about that, write about the return of those kinds of spaces." write about the spaces that I can only go in. I said Chinese weren't allowed, weren't kept out of that park, but they could only come in when they were with a foreigner. She said that's just like what it is now in the late 1980s.
Exactly. I'd like to make a comment. In
sure.
The diplomatic compound, the DRC in Beijing, today, Chinese people are still stopped at the gate. As a foreigner, I doesn't matter who I am, wielded through, and they're still stopped today. That's, I mean, it's just it's outrageous.
Outrageous.
Absolutely. It's a diplomatic compound run by whoever runs it, and certainly not foreigners who run it. It's outrageous. Still.
Wow. Now, I mean, how this cuts both ways was what we were seeing as dangerous. If there were cases to keep us away from polluting, but at the same time, there was that other side of segregation in that old session too. But still in Beijing, still in Beijing. Thank you. I have much to thank you for, Michelle, and now I have my next article.
Yeah.
This is wonderful, yeah. Wonderful. Let's get another question in the back there.
I both of you are involved in publishing and media, and Graham mentioned one respect in which journalists working in China have more freedom than they did more than 20 years ago. But in what ways would you say that restrictions in publishing and media have not changed over this time? And where do you see government involvement in these two areas going in the future?
For me?
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever. Well, I think Li Jia answered in terms of the debates, the open discussion, which occurred in the 80s, is no longer visible in the official media. Of course, there is discussion which is visible until they pull it off in terms of various blogs and message boards on the internet. And that is the balance which has kept China's intelligentsia and the young people from becoming overly frustrated. But it's also pointing the way to the future. In terms of publishing, China remains basically as it was. Everything relates back to the Politburo. There is, as there was then, the opportunity for money to get round whatever the problems were. So assuming there were no political problems, you could get something published then or you could get something published now. Nothing is allowed and everything is possible is a principle that worked as well in the 1980s as it does today.
Books are much prettier now, too. They've become marketable objects, and you know they're more expensive.
Right.
But they're prettier. The bookstores are infinitely better, both as spaces to go to.
Yeah.
So it's always the has it changed? Hasn't it changed? Because there's the both sides of it.
Because
so,
there is and packaging has changed immensely.
Yeah.
But the question is at the core of the core of the core, has it changed? Sorry.
Can I just make a comment about media? Being I'm still a freelance journalist. I think in the 80s, China, the investigative journalism emerged. You know, we saw some of the best ones, Liu Bingyan and Dai Qing. Their books, you know, investigating corruption, they were really sold. They were the best, better than any bestseller books. The media is quite very interesting. I mean, in some ways, this kind of investigative journalism, still exists, but not in the same way. But on the other hand, they will still have good newspapers like the Southern Weekend. And the party is driven by the market, because not to sell newspaper, they still need good stories.
There's the internet. So I think it's really interesting.
There's a question back here. I don't have a question. I'd like to tell Mom that her van has been temporarily lifted.
All right. So, show me, Julie, how? Here we go. A brief chorus. That's very magnanimous. How often does a child do that?
So, unless I have enough people can sing along with me. Anybody knows Shehui Zhu Yihao? A
I know just enough of it. I'll join you. Okay. All right.
Question.
Wait.
We're going to be singing first.
So who is the I saw hand there? Was that?
Oh, it's a question hand. I think we've got to move on.
Oh, Russell, so that, no, that.
Behind there?
Yeah.
You know it too? Come on up.
Come okay, on. May, come on, May. Kirsty, come to join me to sing. Show which
we
are.
Here we go. All right, we better go to the next question. Here we go.
Do you recall anything particular from that decade that you no longer see that you wish you could?
Something that you no longer see that you wish you could. Can I twist that a little bit? Because I think this is important, and Ligia chided me when I was on her talk show about not saying enough about gender in my book. But I certainly liked the fact that in Shanghai at that point I was never approached, asked if I'd be interested in a prostitute. There were prostitutes there, but you didn't get walking as a man on the street approached. There were certainly discussions of male-female equality at that point. It was taken for granted that this was still part of what the new China was about. And that's gone, and it's this mixed blessing because the sort of increased room for femininity has gone along with an abandoning, largely, of the drive for male-female equality at the time, which was one of the positive legacies of both the Mao period. And still in the 80s, it was assumed that women should be as safe walking on the streets at night, that it was really bad that there was only one product to buy, but you didn't see objectified women's bodies selling lots of other products. So that's part of the things that, if you want to think of it that way. But there are other things probably too.
Sorry, you go ahead.
I remain three things. First of all, advertising. China was pretty much advertising free, certainly in the early 80s, and it was only after 89 that it really became all-encompassing as it is today, and as it is, I guess, in the West. And the idea of being in a place where you're not being constantly assailed by ads was a fantastic experience. The second was the sense of peace. In an afternoon, particularly a summer's afternoon, in any place around China, but even in a high density city like Shanghai, the pressures on life, because everybody had a job they couldn't be fired. Nobody had any pressure in terms of progressing in any way, because there was no way that you could progress. And so there was this sense of peace, of lack of stress, which was wonderful. The third was Kiesling's toffees, which came from a store in Tianjin. This is a Beijing issue, rather than all the time. But I've been to the Kiesling's in Tianjin, and firstly, they trashed it, and secondly, the toffees are no longer there.
There are quite a few things I think have gone from the 80s, and I mentioned briefly, the 80s was. That was time, there was still so much passion, there was still so much ideology, and China has gone far too commercialized. And I think, being too practical, that just kills any romance, and romancing in a broad sense. And also, I think one of the many challenges China is facing now is the growing income gap, just horrendous amount, of course, of the regional disparity as well. That's all. Those are the issues that China will have to deal with.
I think there was also that what you could buy was much better quality. And for example, I remember all of the really beautiful silks that were in the silk shop.
That's true.
And the hats and the fan shop and the underwear shop and the bra shop. And so what you could buy was actually quite beautiful and quite well made.
Cashmere.
And you also didn't have to worry about what was fake or not.
Yes, exactly. There.
I'd only add one sort of codicil to Graham's comment. There was a lot of advertising, but there was only advertising for one company, the Chinese Communist Party. Wow. And so you would have the streets festooned. And the quiet that you mentioned, the striving, the lack of stress, that I totally agree with. but the quiet, the loudspeakers that would come on telling you at odd moments.
And riding on trains was just a nightmare because the stridently voiced woman would come on at 6 o'clock or 5:30 and just start just screaming at you. Yes, that is also true. But there was a sense of uniqueness about it. It was different. It was a part of the adventure. That's certainly how I looked at it.
And you would be invited to people's houses for them to cook you wonderful meals, rather than, let's just go out to eat. Because there was no place to go out to eat.
Well, there was Shea Louise.
Yeah. Shoshi. Yeah. The beauty of Napa.
Susie, exactly. Yeah. That's it.
Everybody Susie, yeah. We had a song called Susie Around the Clock. E, R, Sandy, and Cindy, and John.
We have another show, I think, for the next little festival, I think. Yes,
Patty. How do you guys think that at the time, Shanghai is relevant to, student demonstration time, Tiananmen Square? Because basically, at the time, Zone in Beijing is quite, active, you got student activists. The only reason that it failed is based on the information what I heard, is the Guangdong area, everybody's obsessive with money, so nobody going out to demonstrate. Shanghai is also because Chen Zemin is quite successful in clampdown the whole thing, so he did not be promoted as the president. So that's one of the factors that actually in the end the demonstration failed, is because it's only Beijing thing. And also another question is how this materialism we're witnessing now in China, why is it necessary to be a bad thing? For example, the 1960s, you have the student act movement in the United States, civil rights, all this stuff. It's because America has really gotten rich, right? It's not after 20 years, this Democratic Party domination, and then the people get fed up with all the things. So you see the kids there in UC Berkeley, or anywhere else in the campuses, more mobilized.
You've got a couple of really good points and questions in there, but just on a factual thing, the Shanghai protest, in 86, Shanghai was the center of student activism. Hefei and then Shanghai. Beijing barely got into it right before, they didn't march until the movement was just about over and there was a slight crackdown on it. And I think after that, there's such rivalry between the cities, the Beijing students were saying, next time around, we're gonna lead it. And this has actually been a pattern in student protests for a long time.
It's not like Beijing's always being a student
and but also, no, that's true, but also a lot of the reason the protest went on so long in Beijing was that students from the provinces were going to join it to show their students' flags there. And when Beijing students were getting tired, there would be new infusions of students from the provinces. And the students from Beijing maybe were ready to go back to class, but these students said, we want our turn to be there. So it really was the national scope of it that made, in the cities, that made the government so worried about it. Had it just been Beijing, they wouldn't have been nearly as worried. So I think, but your point about a middle class getting restive, this is something we're waiting to see, and we do see some signs of it. There have been increasingly environmental protests that are largely by middle class people who say, now that we've gotten our life to a certain point, we want to have a better quality of life within our cities, which is what some of the protests in other parts of the world have been. So I think you're right to be thinking that there can be a kind of protest that grows out of affluence, as well as one that grows out of deprivation.
Can I just make a point? I think it's very interesting that you look around in many parts of the world that the middle class, the emerging middle class, often played an important role in democratic lives of the country. But in China, I think at least for the moment, the middle class seem to be too content to rock the boat. And I think it's we're talking about in the 80s, in the 1989, after the fact that China, the government doesn't want people to talk about that, doesn't mean they haven't learned a lesson. I think the government really obviously learned a big lesson. So after 1989, basically the government deliberately channels people's energy to making money. And on one hand, keep tight grip to the power, and on the other hand, slowly granting people more personal freedom. And then also deliberately, the government exercised the so-called
selective generosity, deliberately courted the urban professional middle class. Professor, for example, you can say just about anything you want to say, plenty of opportunities to go abroad. When you return to China, you'll be offered a job. The salary may not be high, but there are plenty of perks, subsidized flat and such. And so I think that it's very interesting to see where China will be the democratic process, you know, at least for the moment, since the middle class people are too content.
Are there any more questions, comments? One back there.
Just because Greg mentioned it at the beginning, I'm just kind of curious, what are the ways that you think China hasn't changed since you were
We've been touching on it a little bit in the last few minutes. It's the heart of the heart, the fundamental structure of the political system. Richard McGregor's book, The Party, is well worth reading, and he has a line in there saying that if Lenin was to look under the hood of this machine, he would completely understand the workings of it.
Do you want to jump in? Anything that hasn't changed? What's recognizable from the China of your childhood and the very different China of today?
I think the way the government still wants to keep control, I think, as you know, they are a bit more sensible. I think they put one thing for their own very survival. They realize that they have to make themselves more popular. So that's why I keep mentioning about the personal freedom, which is really important. You know, the matters like high heels, shoes, lipsticks, and the personal freedom, dating, love, and that's all very important. But on the other hand, I think the government still wants, you know, all the important things, they still want to keep control. That's why you see all the dissidents being locked up. And also in terms of media, still under tighter control, that hasn't changed.
And there are all sorts of... Sorry.
Now, I'll just give you an example of the after publication of my book in 2008, spring 2008, a very lucky New York Times reviewed my book, and a very old friend told me I was very happy. I went out to buy, of course, in Beijing, Shanghai too, I'm sure, you can buy International Herald Tribune. And when I bought the copy, I realized the page where the review should have been, just being somebody just tailed out. It didn't even cut. And not just that copy, I checked another copy, it was the same. So, and it was just something that's ridiculous, because anybody can read that, it can just read it online. But still, I think, again, since I mentioned that, I just think it's quite interesting, because, you know, I talk about organized demonstration. The book is, I'm not sure I can just get it in, import in through a normal channel. But on the other hand, many people ask me, you know, I write articles, and my articles have often been critical of the government, and people often ask me if I'm okay in China. I'm all right. And I think China is really quite such a mixed bag. It's such a confused place. And I think, at least for myself, if I do not label myself as dissident, I do not belong to any organization. You know, the government hates organization. That's why Falun Gong is being wiped up. And I say, if I write English, it looks like I'm okay. Oh, I hope so. In the unlikely event, I ended up in a gulag somewhere in Tibet. Please lobby for my case.
We'll come and visit.
You will. I know you will.
One more place to walk.
Okay. Okay. Nice thing to Tibet. You walked all the way to Tibet.
Thank you. Thank you all for these comments. And please buy Li Jiao's book. Please for Ed and mine if you will, if you've got some extra change. And we'll be happy to sign books or to answer questions or to continue some of the conversation privately after that. Thanks again. Thanks to you all.